This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. First Lady Michelle Obama announced on Wednesday a partnership with Sesame Street to let the produce industry market fruits and veggies to kids using spokes Muppets like Elmo.
So how do you guys feel about getting kids pumped up and excited about eating healthy
food? Well, it's wonderful. Emma loves healthy foods. Emma thinks that fruits and vegetables are delicious.
Yes. See, me too. And you know what? They help us grow healthy and strong. Check out these muscles.
Let me see.
Even before this program kicks off, there seems to be some good news on the child obesity front. The CDC recently released a report that after years, obesity rates amongst kids are dropping, especially amongst low-income children. In Connecticut, though, rates remained about the same. Yale's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity is a national leader in this field. Joining us today on the program is their new director, Marlene Schwartz. She's been studying obesity in Connecticut for years at Yale, evaluating school lunches and schools and food sold in markets in low-income communities. Also joining us today, Ann Ferris from the UConn Health Center. And we want you to join the conversation. Are you watching what your kids eat on this Halloween? What are you seeing in your kids' school lunchrooms? You can call us at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can tweet us at Where We Live. Later on, we'll talk to a Brown researcher who's working to find effective strategies to help obese kids lose weight. Dr. Marlene Schwartz joins us from Yale University's studios in New Haven, director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
It's great to be here.
And Ann Ferris is director of the Center for Public Health and Health Policy at the University of Connecticut. Thank you, Ann, for coming in.
Same here.
So, Dr. Schwartz, let's start actually where a lot of parents' minds are today. It's Halloween, and by tonight, an awful lot of kids are going to have an awful lot of candy. How much candy should parents let their kids eat tonight?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think that some parents feel like Halloween, it's sort of, eat what you can for this one night, and then the candy gets taken away. Other parents try to space it out over time. What we actually do in our house for our part is instead of giving out candy, we give out little Halloween toys. We've been doing this for a number of years where we order really hundreds of toys because we live in a town where there are a lot of trick-or-treaters. And we give kids a choice of little, rubber balls and stretchy skeletons and little pumpkins and things like that. And so we try to just get the message out there that it doesn't have to be all about candy.
Ann Ferris, does that sound about right to you?
Yes, that's what I did for many years until my daughters just revolted and at one point just said, Mom, we have to give out candy this year. So what I do is have just that little toy and then real small little piece, the little small bits of candy.
We played that tape of the Muppets with Michelle Obama off the top, and one of the things that we hear in the language of Sesame Street these days is Cookie Monster, who, of course, is, a monster who likes cookies, and he eats cookies all the time. He now says the cookies are a sometimes food. This is something that is they're trying to get across. Is that part of the sort of message that parents should be trying to get to kids this time of year, that, yeah, it's okay to have candy, but just not every single day, all the time? Ann, what do you say?
Well, on trick-or-treat, it's treat, and that's an occasional something. And with the same with something like cookies, it's not part of what you need to have every day. And so that's a message that parents should be giving to their kids.
So Dr. Schwartz, talk us through this a little bit, because I think a lot of parents struggle with this every single day. They see their kids going into a school where all the other kids seem to be treated not every now and again, but treated every single day. There's candy in every school lunch. It's not just something that you have once a week. What are some strategies for parents to talk to kids, or maybe for people like you to talk to parents, so that people understand a little bit better how things like Halloween candy and just sweets in general should be apportioned throughout the eating week?
Right. Well, I think it is really complicated because, people sometimes feel like there are special occasions all the time. And so what I really recommend is that you focus on the bulk of your diet being the sorts of foods that you should be eating. And everybody knows what those are. But it's perfectly fine to have dessert. And dessert is a once a day occurrence. And so in our family, the kids know that they can have one dessert a day and they can choose to either have it after school or after dinner, or if they go to a birthday party, that's their dessert. And so it's this idea that it is fine to have, a couple hundred calories that you would, as a sort of nutrition professional, you would call empty calories. That's how the USDA refers to them. And that's fine, but it's 200, not, 500 or 600 a day. And so that's how we've chosen to deal with it in our house.
Counting calories for kids, is that something that parents should be concerned about? Because calories are one way to look at the health of products. Another way to look at it is how much sugar someone is consuming. Give us a little breakdown about what the things to really look for are when it comes to what kids are eating every day.
Well, I don't know that it's helpful for children to count calories. I think that what you want to do is really teach them what a good breakfast, lunch, and dinner looks like. And so serving, you know, meals that look like my plate, you know, that have fruits, vegetables, whole grains, low fat protein. So that's, you don't need to get them to count calories there. I do think the place, though, where it's useful for kids to understand the concept of calories is when it comes to these treat or dessert type foods. So they should have a sense of what a certain serving is of potato chips or french fries or candy so that they understand how much is a reasonable portion and how to fit that into their day.
And portion size, Ann, is something that has changed over time. The amount of food that a child would be expected to eat at any one sitting probably has adjusted since I was growing up, when we thought that a portion size was, you know, as much as you could eat. That's as much as was available. And it seems as though that's something that schools and parents are trying to get across in a slightly different way about what portion size actually means.
Right. And actually, the caloric content, that the children consume in the day has gone up quite a bit. You know, my focus is mainly with very young children before they get to school. And some of the data that we have from Hartford is that the calories are about over twice what that child would need for their weight. That is served to that child every day. So part of it is that looking at the quality of the diet, but a very critical part is the total quantity of the diet.
We're taking a big look at childhood obesity today, and there's a lot of new research out about it, and we're going to be talking a little bit later about some trends that we've seen. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, especially if you have some strategies for healthy eating for your kids, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. Marlene Schwartz, there's a CDC report out that says the rates of obesity for low-income kids are going down in some places. This seems like really good news. I guess the first question is, talk a little bit about this trend nationwide, and then where does Connecticut fall on the national trend map?
Sure. Well, I do think that we are starting to at least see some leveling off and maybe even some decrease in childhood obesity nationally. And I really attribute that to the attention that the issue has gotten in recent years. And some of the really big changes nationally have been things like changing the WIC food package. So that's the Women, Infant, and Children program, where low-income women can obtain coupons to get healthy foods to feed themselves and their family. And in 2009, there was a very significant change to what was included in that package, where it was switched to low-fat, dairy, whole grains, more fruits and vegetables. And so in my mind, I attribute those kinds of big policy changes as the reason that we're starting to see some progress.
And the ability for people to start to shop, in Connecticut at least, at farmers markets, to buy fresh food that's locally sourced and maybe food that people wouldn't have normally sought out or been able to afford.
That's true. I think that people are much more aware of things like farmers markets, and farmers markets in our state certainly have made a big effort to allow people to use benefits like WIC or like food stamps, the SNAP program. The other thing that's sort of interesting about Connecticut is we did do a study to look at what foods were available in low-income neighborhoods before and after those changes took place to the WIC food package. And what we saw is that once the stores were required to have these healthier foods in order to participate, you saw much higher prevalence of those foods. And so what's nice about that is then it helps everybody, not just the women on WIC, but everybody then has access to the healthier foods in those neighborhoods.
So we are seeing, Ann, better foods in neighborhood markets. That's something that we've been charting over the years, that there are places that have long been called food deserts, where people can't get a good, healthy meal anywhere near them, and that's starting to change, you see, Ann?
Well, I think, just as Marlene said, that the major driver is whether a store is WIC certified or not. The Donahue Foundation funded us to do a study on the healthy food marketing program that the Hartford Food System was doing. And what we found, that just whether a store was WIC or not was a much greater determinant of whether there was going to be healthier foods listed in that store. That doesn't say everything about the quality of the food, though. Mm. And so when you think, when you talk about access, quality is still a very major issue.
When you say quality, what exactly do you mean?
Well, you can have a peach, but it can be a peach that has been there for quite a few days. There can be bananas and apples, but not very much. So it is variety as well as just the quality of that food. So I think that's where a lot of the work that we're trying to do now is around trying to help the store owners access better quality food, and then be doing education to the individuals in the community so that they feel more comfortable buying that food there.
When we take a look at the CDC report, Marlene Schwartz, that says that overall low-income kids are doing a little bit better when it comes to childhood obesity, Connecticut hasn't seen quite as much of a statistical change.
Yeah, well, Connecticut's kind of a funny state because we are definitely at the high end of income overall across the country. So we're not really typical of the national picture. And then at the same time, we do have these dramatic disparities. So we have overall a rate of childhood obesity that's around 25%, but it ranges from 44% for Black children, 31% for Hispanic children, and then 22% for white children. So it's a little hard to take all of Connecticut's data together and draw any conclusions.
One thing that I wanted to sort of get at when you were making the point earlier, Anne, about quality as opposed to just something that's healthy, but it might not be of good quality. I think another question that I want to tease out with the two of you is how we've, because we have a childhood obesity problem in America, how we have linked the word obesity with health of children. And those two aren't exactly apples to apples all the time, to use a fruit metaphor. It just seems as though sometimes there are plenty of unhealthy children who may not be obese, and there may be some overweight kids who aren't as unhealthy. Anne, talk that through a little bit, and I'd like Marlene to jump in as well. I think it's an important distinction.
It's, you know, when I thought about what are the two points I want to make today, that was absolutely one of them. Weight is not the only standard for health, and especially among low-income children, you know, many of the children have asthma. They have iron deficiency anemia, especially those 18-month and 2-year-olds in the city. And when you have asthma or when you have iron deficiency anemia, you don't have any energy. So, and we know from national data that those two things are related with increased obesity. It's not causative, it's associative. So I think what we need to be looking at is not only what weight standards are with children, but what is the functional ability of those children? Not that do they exercise, but can they exercise? And what is the duration of what they can do? And, you know, one of the things that working in the international sphere, when you go into a village where there's supposed to be malnutrition, the first thing you do is you look at the 3-year-olds. And if they're quiet little children in a corner sitting with their mother and not interacting, immediately you know there's a problem. Because 3-year-olds are supposed to be up and running and bothering you and greeting you. And, you know, when you go into clinics in Hartford, and many of the clinics, you'll see children are being very well behaved. But very well behaved in that they're sitting on their mother's lap and not doing anything. They're just lethargic. And those are sick children. They might be obese, but they need to be treated. I think that's the message that a lot of the pediatricians treating this want to get to, you know, to policymakers, is that we can't focus everything on obesity. We have to be looking at that whole child.
Dr. Schwartz, could you pick up on that distinction a bit for me?
Well, I completely agree with that. I think that, you know, body mass index is good for sort of a public health surveillance, you know, tool, and to kind of look at large groups of kids over time. But when you're really looking at individual children, you have to look at much more than the body weight. You, as Anne said, you need to look at what else is happening to them nutritionally. You have to look at the quality of their diet and their physical activity. And that comes up a lot when people talk about this, the role of schools in terms of tracking BMI. And I'm really in favor of the tracking sort of as a public health surveillance tool. But in terms of giving parents feedback about their child's BMI, I think it has to be a much more comprehensive picture where you really assess a number of things about that child's health and then figure out what would be best for moving forward.
We're talking with Marlene Schwartz, who's the director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. She joins us today from the New Haven studios of Yale. Anne Ferris is here in our studio. She's director of the Center for Public Health and Health Policy at the University of Connecticut. We want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. As we talk about childhood obesity on the program, do you have strategies for healthy eating for your kids? Questions about the quality of school lunches or the availability of fresh foods? 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we're talking about childhood obesity. There have been some good trends, some good statistics coming out, but there's still an awful lot of work to be done, and we're talking with a few experts in the field here in Connecticut. Dr. Marlene Schwartz from Yale's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity, here in our studio from the University of Connecticut. Ann Ferris is Director of the Center for Public Health and Health Policy. We're taking your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Emails wherewelive at WNPR.org. We do want to hear from parents. Strategies for healthy eating for their kids, the lunches that they send in with their kids to school, or maybe the school lunches that are provided. Let's just quickly go to a few phone calls here. Emily is calling from Old Saybrook. Hi, Emily. Hi, Emily. You're on the air. We're going to put Emily on hold and see if Seth is there. Hi, Seth. You're in Groton, and you're on Where We Live.
Morning, John.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
Not much. One thing real quick. Who does your intro music? I love it.
Oh, the intro music, and we'll put up more information on our website, is by Aphex Twin. It's a song called Flim, and we'll put up more information on WNPR.org. A very good question, but what is your question regarding childhood obesity today, Seth?
Oh, not a question. I have a comment.
Yeah.
I'm 6'3", 25 years old, 255 pounds, and I grew up every morning making a peanut butter sandwich going to school and eating carrots when I got home from work.
And that's how you grew up. You peanut butter sandwiches and carrots.
That's it.
And did you feel healthy?
Absolutely. I ate like a bird, but when I did eat, I enjoyed it.
And Seth, you say 6'3", 255. Have you ever considered that you have problems with your weight, or has that ever been a problem in your life?
Not really. I'm very athletic. I stay very active, and I'm a lot more healthy than most of my friends.
Well, Seth, thank you very much. I really appreciate your phone call. And you know, and it's funny, you know, when we were playing the tape earlier from the Muppets, who were out on the White House lawn with Michelle Obama kicking off this new program. It's something that we grew up with as kids, but
right.
It's something that I think is still being taught, which is you can grow up, you know, strong and healthy, eating really, really good foods. Seth is saying that to us right now.
Right. Except Seth wouldn't be able to eat his peanut butter sandwich because most schools won't allow peanut butter in because of so many children have allergies. So that he would have some difficulty with that. But, you know, I think one of the things also with what they're trying to do with Let's Move and the Obama, Michelle Obama's program, is that many of the children, especially, you know, children who have come from more limited resources, don't even know what many of the fruits and vegetables are. You know, with some of the work that we have, a third of the children couldn't recognize a strawberry and name it. Also, about the same number couldn't recognize a blueberry. So those are very common kinds of fruits and vegetables, and it tells you a little bit about what's really available in many of those communities for kids to eat on a daily basis. And for many of the daycares where they might be or the early childhood, those are sometimes very expensive fruits, you know, items to have on a menu. So kids will know a banana, they'll know an apple, and they'll know an orange, but that's about it.
Well, and that education piece, Marlene Schwartz, is big. I've done some work with CSA farms in the state that have provided food for low-income communities, and often the stuff they grow is very, very good for you. But if you get in a basket a bunch of kohlrabi and kale to make for your children and you don't know what to do with it, it's not going to be much better than a box of cereal, I suppose.
I agree. I think that things like CSAs, though, are wonderful. I mean, I've learned a few things from what's shown up in my bag as well. So, you know, this idea of just exposing families to a greater variety of fruits and vegetables and, you know, teaching them about them, giving them, you know, these things in their childcare centers and schools, I think that's really a great way to move forward.
Letty's calling from Hebron. Hi there, Letty. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a big concern because, you know, you mentioned that the vegetables and fruits, and my thing is that vegetables, well, actually fruits are more expensive than a granola bar. Like, I go to very inexpensive stores, and the oranges are like a dollar you know, everything is very expensive. And when you go through the aisles of granola bars, and they give you five for a dollar. So I want the better things for my kids, but sometimes I cannot afford very nutritious diet.
It's a great point you bring up, and I thank you for calling it and raising it. And Dr. Schwartz, this is something that we hear over and over again. Look, if food, you know, the sort of things that are called food that are in the central aisles of grocery stores that have prepackaged and have a lot of calories in them are very, very cheap and provide some sort of sustenance. A lot of people say, well, why wouldn't I buy that? I mean, an organic carrot, I'm sure, is great, but I just can't afford that. What do we do about that problem?
It's a really, really big problem. There are some examples of ways that you can buy, you know, less expensive fruits or vegetables, sometimes doing a little bit of preparation. So, like, for example, you know, buying raw potatoes as opposed to buying a bag of potato chips. So you can sometimes get more for your money, but you do have to do some preparation with them. But the other way that we've been trying to think about this at the Rudd Center is to use strategies to really restructure this economic picture. And one idea that's been talked about is taxing some of the less healthy foods like sugar-sweetened beverages and then using that money to subsidize the fruits and vegetables so that we can turn that around.
What do you think about this, Anne? Because it's controversial, this idea of taxing the foods that we like but that are bad for us. Do you see this as a program that works?
I'm more on incentivizing people to buy the right food, and I think it's a form of what Marlene was talking about. But I do want to emphasize, as the caller is talking about, we can't underestimate how much it costs to feed a family, and that's why some of the national discussions that are happening now about the food stamp reductions are so important. But there are some strategies, and one of those is, you know, we have to really examine whether the quantity that we give our children is really what is needed, and that's helping families do that is not such an easy thing to do for them to feel is, are my children getting enough food to eat? And then looking at, well, with that same quantity and that same amount of money, how could we still have the child have a fruit or a vegetable? And especially fruits, because they are more expensive, and for to serve it in smaller portions. So I think that incentivizing, I know what we're looking at things in the state right now with giving people extra value on food stamps if they buy fruits and vegetables or buy foods that have higher nutritious value. But it's not such an easy thing to do. So.
And just to pick up on what you said, I mean, we're just hearing even today that cuts are being finalized to food stamp programs nationwide. What do you see as the impact on this on families trying to feed themselves, feed their children?
Devastating. You know, when you look at how difficult it is for people to get food, I'm thinking mainly in the city where we're sitting right now, and how little resources they have to buy that food, these cuts will have an unbelievable impact on how these families function. And so I'm hoping that there's some enlightenment in Washington, and they won't be as drastic as we think they might be.
Mm. Hoping for enlightenment in Washington perhaps is something that we might have to wait for a while on. I want to bring in our next guest, and if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Dr. Elisa Jalalian is an associate professor of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University in Rhode Island, and she's going to tell us about some of her research. Dr. Jalalian, welcome to Where We Live.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So maybe you can talk about some of the work that you're doing at Brown, working to find strategies for helping teens who are struggling with their weight.
Yeah, I mean, I think first I want to say it's tremendous that we've had the changes we've had in terms of policy and helping kids grow up in a healthy environment, so that hopefully I won't need to be doing research in this area 10 years down the road. But for those teens who do have issues with weight, some of the things we've been looking at are, you know, what are the best ways to help them? And so we've looked at trying to involve peers, because we know peers are important to teens. We've also looked at ways of involving parents. For example, we know in younger children, strong parental involvement and making change at a family level is the most effective way to go. we weren't so sure about that with teens. And in fact, in a study we just conducted, we found that when parents were too involved, if you will, teens actually backed up a little bit and didn't take as much ownership around their own eating and health behaviors. So it turns out that teens want a little more autonomy and independence around this, you know, still with parental involvement. So those are some of the things we've found more recently.
The involvement of peers is really interesting. I wonder if you can talk more about this, because obviously, as we've seen time and time again, you know, one of the struggles that schools are dealing with, along with childhood obesity and many other things, is the problem of bullying. You know, teens who are not nice to each other to the point where it can be devastating, very, very damaging. Talk about that peer relationship when it comes to the very dicey issue of weight and food.
Right. So we know that weight can be a very stigmatizing issue, and particularly for teens who are very focused on appearance and who are in that kind of culture. So what we've tried to do is cultivate peer support within our weight control interventions, such that, you know, kids come together who may feel otherwise isolated or ostracized. Not always the case, but for those who do, we bring them together in groups where they can sort of share some of those stories, where they can be with other kids who are struggling with similar issues. And we found that that really supports not only weight loss, but also improvements in self-concept, and actually decreases in their anxiety about being with other teens.
So some of the other things that are out in the press these days can, I know you've been looking at, can cause issues and problems. For instance, stories about eating disorders. Magazine articles come out that say heavy kids who lose weight are at a higher rate for eating disorders, and this maybe kicks off another entire problem. What have you found about this issue? Because it's, again, something that the press will pick up on very, very quickly.
Right. So there is an article in a prestigious journal suggesting that, you know, based on a couple of case studies, that kids who are overweight or struggling with excess weight who endeavor to change their weight are actually at increased risk for then struggling with things like anorexia or bulimia. And I think historically, these two worlds have not spoken to each other. So it's been sort of obesity on one side of the continuum and eating disorders on the other. And I think we really need to think more around these behaviors as a continuum. So thinking about what kids do to regulate their weight, and that can be a problem whether a child happens to be above a certain weight cutoff or below a certain weight cutoff. And so I think we want to be careful about not giving the message that someone who is at excess weight cannot in a healthy way, you know, achieve a healthier weight.
I want to quickly bring back in Marlene Schwartz again from the Rudd Center, and maybe you can tell us a bit more about some of these questions we've been discussing with Dr. Jalalian around weight stigma and discrimination and how some of this stuff works with teenagers.
Yes, well, I completely agree that historically the eating disorders field and the obesity field haven't done a great job talking to each other, and I'm hoping that that'll get better. But we've been studying weight bias and discrimination for a number of years and have found that it definitely occurs at a pretty high level, especially with teenagers feeling criticized, interestingly, not just by their peers, but sometimes reporting feeling stigmatized by their own parents or by their doctors because they feel, you know, like they all want them to lose weight. But I guess I really go back to this idea that changing our environment is really a win-win. You know, that if we can take some of that responsibility off of the individual and really make an environment where it's much easier for people to make the healthier choice, that is going to help everyone, because then it's not just about a child, you know, tracking her own eating, trying to lose weight, but it's about, you know, making a school environment or a community environment one where everybody, no matter what their weight is, has an easier time eating well and being healthy.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, as we talk about childhood obesity and some strategies to try to turn around this trend. I want to bring back in Dr. Lisa Jalalian from Brown University. And you've got an upcoming study. You're trying to enroll teens in this. Tell us a bit more about this.
I would love to. So we have been enrolling teens who have successfully lost weight and kept it off for a year. It doesn't have to be a dramatic amount of weight. And what we've been trying to document is what things like what got them started, what helped them, what was the role of their peers and their family in that process. And the reason we want to do that is, one, to document there is such a thing as healthy weight control among adolescents. And two, we think these teens have so much to teach us in terms of what are effective strategies and approaches. And I guess I just want to, you know, comment back on something Dr. Schwartz said. I couldn't agree more that, you know, we have kids who have their own biologies, who live within a family, who live within a neighborhood, within a context. And the more the context is one that is supportive and healthy, the easier it is going to be for all of these teens, regardless of their weight status.
If people want to find out more about the work that you're doing, Dr. Jalali, how would they get in touch?
We have, through the Weight Control and Diabetes Research Center, we have a website, www.weightresearch.org, and we'd be happy to hear from teens or parents of teens or about what their particular stories are.
We'll have more information on our website as well, links to all the things that we're talking about today at WNPR.org. Dr. Jalalian, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
We're going to get to some more phone calls here at 860-275-7266. We want to get back to Emily, who joined us before, and I think I lost her call, and I think Emily's back. Hi, Emily. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, I'm here.
You're here. What's on your mind?
I guess I'm bringing it back to the younger age. I'm calling as a nurse and a lactation consultant, and I wanted to hear from the panel about any efforts to increase breastfeeding, awareness of breastfeeding. I'm also a young mom, and when I was going through my peri-childbirth, I really didn't get any support or information about breastfeeding, really no promotion from the doctors, just kind of, how are you planning to feed your baby, as if formula is exactly the same as breastfeeding. And we know that, you know, breastfeeding helps reduce the incidence of asthma, of, you know, helping to establish healthy eating so that children tend to be less obese, less overeat, eating when they're stressed, and all these sorts of comorbidities that we're worried about now, like diabetes. So, I just wanted to bring breastfeeding into the discussion.
Well, Emily, thank you very much. And this is the sort of thing that you can't see in the studio. When you brought up breastfeeding, Ann Ferris, who's here with me, pumps her fist and goes, yes, like something happened in the Red Sox game last night. So pick up on this, Ann. What do you want to tell us about this?
Well, I think a lot of these discussions are talking about adolescents or school-age children. And, Emily, you've just really hit it. You know, we can really prevent – if we're going to prevent obesity, it has to be in the very early childhood. We can predict – whether a child's going to be obese at the age of 3 by how quickly they grow in the first year of life. So, you know, it's having a child that's born of adequate weight for height, for the mother to be breastfeeding, for there to be delayed introduction of complementary foods, for those complementary foods to be appropriate, for the child to get enough sleep. And, you know, even with a newborn, that screen time, you know, they're not sleeping with the computer monitor next to them on. And, you know, if there are some of those very critical things that you talk about, we could really do something to curb the childhood obesity problem. And I also think that one of the other things that is very important is that when we talk about childhood obesity, it's a cutoff. So if we think of somebody as 200 pounds reached that cutoff, and we'll call them obese, but the person who's 400 pounds is also in that category. And I think that's the thing that we're not really looking at, is we may be having children be not so much in those higher categories, but there are more children now who are in that morbid obese category. And that's where, you know, for example, in the study that we did last year in the Hartford preschools, you know, you look at 5% of children in normal distribution should be in the obese category. We found that there were 4 times that many children. And many of those children, from the time they were, you know, very young, were really being fed much, much more than they needed to be fed. And so by the time they're coming to school, they can barely walk.
But when when a brand new mother, a first-time mother, is feeding their child, and if, as Emily right. shared with us, when a doctor says, how are you going to feed your baby? I mean, I think a lot of people's answer is, I don't know. How the hell am I supposed to feed my baby? I've never done this before. I think that one marker that a lot of parents would have is my baby growing
right.
healthy? I don't want a tiny, small baby who doesn't eat. I want a baby who eats food. And this research and what you're talking about, I think, might be different news than what a lot of mothers have heard, I suppose.
Right, but there's an appropriate weight. And I yes. think what Emily said, which is really important, is moms need counseling in the prenatal period on how they're going to feed their child, because you're overwhelmed when you have a new baby. You can't make be decisions. You can't be making decisions then. You have to be making them beforehand. And there are programs, as she said, the lactation consultant. There's programs that we have some baby-friendly hospitals in the state. The Hispanic Health Council has a lactation counseling program for low-income mothers that's been very successful. So there are lots of things that we can replicate that are going to make it easier for moms of all income levels to be feeding their babies appropriately in that very first period. And babies can be tracked. So it isn't that they shouldn't be growing, but they're growing at such a high rate that it is predisposing those kids to be obese later on.
We have to take a break in a moment, but Dr. Schwartz, do you want to weigh in at all on this issue of brand new children, newborns, and how we feed them? Any new research on this that we should know about?
Well, I just want to follow up on what Anne said about the baby-friendly hospitals. So this is really an effort to change the hospital environment so that, like when I had my kids, I got free samples of formula as I walked out the door. And, you know, you can really change that. Because when you first have your baby, if you have the nurses really helping you breastfeed, if you have a lactation consultant, if your insurance company covers for someone to come to your home, that can make a huge difference. And there's been a big national effort to really get the formula companies out of the picture. Because the last people you want educating the mothers about how to feed their babies is the formula companies.
We're talking today about childhood obesity with Dr. Marlene Schwartz from the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. Anne Ferris is here. She's from the Center for Public Health and Health Policy at the University of Connecticut. When we come back, we're going to take some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're back in downtown Hartford at our pop-up storefront right on Trumbull Street. It's right underneath the marquee for the Excel Center. We've broadcast there for a few times so far, but we're going to have our first live concert from our pop-up storefront. The best indie rock band at this year's Connecticut Music Awards is Little Ugly, and they're going to be joining us for a concert in our pop-up studio. We'll also be checking in with our co-tenants in this space, the Hartford Denim Company, making handcrafted jeans right here in Connecticut. So hope you can join us live on Trumbull Street in downtown Hartford tomorrow on Where We Live. Today we're talking about childhood obesity. Yes, we're doing it on Halloween, and there's going to be a lot of candy eaten tonight, but we are checking some trends and some of the latest research with our guests. And we're also taking your phone calls at 860-275-7266. So let's go to Sarah first in West Hartford. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes. I live in West Hartford, and the West Hartford Public School System has been working closely with a group of parent volunteers that formed an organization called Growing Great Schools. And they started out by trying to improve some of the nutritional value and quality of the food in the lunchroom. And what they found out was some of the challenges with the National School Lunch Program, where they each school lunch program, they're their own cost center, so they have to cover their costs. Mm-hmm. They get no funding from the Board of Education. And so if they what has happened is they've introduced healthier foods, recipes developed by chefs, and unfortunately, what happens is the kids don't eat them, they don't buy them, so demand goes down in the lunchroom, and the school cafeteria has to start reintroducing the more, quote-unquote, kid-friendly foods where the demand is higher so that they can cover their costs.
Mm.
In addition, they also have to cover their costs by selling products called competitive foods, which are things like bags of pretzels, Doritos, chips, those kinds of things that help them meet their budget. So it's very complicated because the nutrition services. Hello, are you there? Still there?
Oh, we're still there. We're listening to you, Sarah.
Okay. So the nutrition services wants to improve the quality of the food they're providing, but they also have to balance that with covering their costs.
Well, and it's a great question. And what I'll do is I'm going to put this right now to Marlene Schwartz. And I know this is something you've been following. This is a really important point for a lot of school districts.
Yeah, so we've been following this issue for a number of years, especially in Connecticut. And one thing that I think is important for people to understand is that the competitive foods that you mentioned, the chips and ice cream and things like that, are a serious problem. And in our research, what we found is that when schools actually get rid of those, that their participation in the school lunch program goes up. And so, you know, you'd want to really sort of eliminate the ability for kids to, you know, choose some dessert instead of lunch. So that's one point. And about 3/4 of the districts in Connecticut participate in something called healthy food certification, where they have to follow certain nutrition standards. And those standards get updated every year and certainly, you know, can continue to improve. But the other point that I think is important to understand is that the district can decide to invest in the school lunch program. So it is definitely the case that, you know, most school districts tell the lunch program, essentially, you're on your own, you need to cover your own expenses. But there are districts that have chosen to put some of those expenses onto the general budget and subsidize, for example, the salary of the director of the lunch program and things like that. So it's not quite as black and white as it sounds.
You were also talking quickly about those standards and how they could use to be improved over time. They have improved, but I mean, we hear the stories of, you know, ketchup as a vegetable, tater tots as a vegetable. How are we doing as far as the standards that healthy foods actually have to reach?
Yeah, so there was a similar ketchup vegetable story when the USDA released the new standards for the school lunch. So this is, you know, the official school lunch for the country. They wanted to make it so that the sauce on the pizza would not count as a vegetable, and the makers of frozen pizza lobbied their congresspeople, and that decision got reversed. So it does become tremendously political, but I think that the new standards, which really just did start getting implemented last year and this year of the school lunch, are a huge step in the right direction. And what we're going to see soon are new competitive food standards, which I think is going to really help push the unhealthy snacks out of the schools.
And see, now I'm doing something, Marlene, that you can't see, so I'm slapping my forehead. The frozen pizza lobby has such pull in Washington, but it just seems as though this is where we are. John's in Bridgeport. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. My observation is it has to do with the piece of exercise I'm not hearing people talk about a lot. I know nutrition is really important in reducing childhood obesity, but what about emphasizing, you know, a baseline expectation for exercise? In my experience with my 9-year-old son and his school, there seems to be such an emphasis on using all the time available for preparing for testing and the hysteria about catching up, and a de-emphasis on getting kids outside doing exercise. And there seems to be an emphasis in our culture generally for young people to pursue very sedentary activities. Thanks a lot. I'll take you off. I'll listen to your answer.
Well, thank you, John, very much. And this is a really big issue. We haven't really brought up exercise so much. So what do we need to say about exercise when it comes to this issue?
Well, I think when any of the school systems are looking at their child wellness, the healthy wellness councils, exercise is just as critical a piece. And it is and we look at certification of particularly early child care centers by whether they have space available for exercise and what's appropriate exercise for kids. I think that the one thing that is, and we're now going back to actually putting physical education back in the schools, again, at an additional expense, but I think it's very important. It's a culture that children now don't have that you and I maybe had when we were growing up. Sometimes we didn't like it. We didn't like changing, but we had that opportunity every day. And I also think that the other thing that's very critical in the exercise piece is what's available for children after school. And, you know, with safety issues, parents don't want to let their children just go out and run. It's not just all organized exercise, but it's just the being able to just freely go out and run and do things in an adventurous way that are going to expend a lot of activity. And for many parents, that's an issue. They've got to be with their children. They've got to be watching them. There's not an environment for them to be doing it. So it's not just a school program problem. It's a community problem. And what Marlene was talking about earlier is that we really have to create an environment where it's very easy to be able to get as much activity as you like.
But Marlene, you know, picking up from our Brown researcher earlier talking about, you know, putting this really in the hands of the teenagers themselves and getting better results, it seems as though this not organized approach, actually giving people time to exercise on their own and go out and do things, is something that would probably work. But again, our society seems to be moving kids away from free time and away from things that would allow them to do just that.
I think that's true. And I, you know, it is this interesting balance. One strategy that's been used in other parts of the country is what they call joint use agreements between the schools and the community, where essentially they agree to make the school gym and the school grounds available for community use. And I think that, you know, that after school time is a great time to try to get the extra activity time because of the challenges getting it in during the school day. So I think communities can, you know, be creative in terms of finding ways to, you know, provide some supervision, but also a lot of opportunity for freedom so that students can get that physical activity after school.
We got a call from Susan in Fairfield. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi. You know, I had a comment. I have a daughter who's 14. She just started ninth grade, and she's a day student at a private boarding school, and she's at a very healthy weight. But what we found is that even in what you might, an environment where you might expect there to be better choices, she has to bring her own lunch in order to eat healthy. You know, the cafeteria has very fattening, you know, starchy, not good choices. The salad is drenched in dressing. And I guess I was just getting to the point of the earlier panelists who were saying how important the environment is and making it easy to eat healthy, because fortunately for her, she's kind of proactive about wanting to maintain her healthy weight. And, you know, she asked me if I would could pack her a healthy lunch, so I said sure. But, you know, it's just interesting that even in what one might consider to be an environment that would be provide healthier choices, they really don't.
Well, I think you raise a really good point, Susan, and I know Dr. Schwartz, this is a problem. This is something that we see. I know Ann Ferris is working with kids who are in preschool programs, and a lot of times they get sent in their lunches by parents, and sometimes those lunches are not very healthy, and these are parents that can afford to give healthy lunches. What do we do to change this? Because it seems to be a bigger problem than just low-income communities and struggling school districts.
Well, I think that private schools are interesting because they may or may not participate in the National School Lunch Program. And if they do participate in the National School Lunch Program, there should be some standards. But if they're not, then it really does fall to the parent and student community to try to connect with the food service at that school and see if you can make some changes. One tool is this idea of a school wellness committee. And these are all over the country that every school district that does participate in a federal food program is required to have one. And those committees are required to include parents and students. So if you're in a district where you really have questions about what's happening in your school, contact the superintendent's office and find out when the wellness committee meets and try to get on that committee so you can have some influence.
We just have about a minute or so left. Dr. Schwartz, anything new in your world that we should be looking for? Any new research or anything you can tip us off to?
Well, one of the things that, you know, we're really interested in is looking at the emergency food system. So, you know, Dr. Ferris mentioned SNAP and the cuts to SNAP. And one of our big concerns is that that's going to put more pressure on the food banks in our state and the food pantries. And we just want to make sure that the foods that are being distributed there are also healthy, you know, and especially for the kids. And so we're starting to pay a lot of attention of what's happening in that system in our state.
Ann Ferris, how about you? Anything new in your world that we should end with, new trends?
Well, I think one of the things that we've focused on is sugar-sweetened beverages, and that's one of the areas that I've done a lot of work in. But I think one of the things that's come out of that work is that there are that 8% of the calories perhaps for children are from sugar-sweetened beverages, but there are other significant foods, that single foods that are providing a lot of calories that we also should target, pizza being one of them.
Oh, and I love pizza. Ann Ferris from the University of Connecticut, thank you so much for your time today. Thanks also to Marlene Schwartz from the Rudd Center at Yale University. Our program is produced by Katie Talarski and Tucker Ives. If you want to continue this conversation online, go to WNPR.org and look for our show page. You can continue the conversation there. I hope you can join us live in downtown Hartford tomorrow at our pop-up storefront right on Trumbull Street. We've got a live concert with Little Ugly. Hope you can join us on tomorrow's Where We Live.